It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a trip back to Wisconsin's prehistoric past and find out why Wisconsin dinosaurs may have headed for Wyoming millions of years ago. First, the U.S. is planning to take its military involvement in Iraq in a different direction. President Biden announced this week an end to America's combat mission by the end of the year. There are about 2,500 U.S. troops there, and it looks like they're going to stay. Biden says they'll transition to an advisory and training role. Here he is with Iraq's prime minister at the White House on Monday.
You know, we support strengthening Iraq's democracy, and we're anxious to make sure the election goes forward in October. And we're also committed to our security cooperation. Our shared fight against ISIS is critical for the stability of the region, and our counterterrorism cooperation will continue, even as we shift to this new phase we're going to be talking about.
The announcement comes as the U.S. pulls all of its troops out of Afghanistan this summer. Meanwhile, the Taliban has reportedly taken over parts of that country, including some key border control points. There have been reports of attacks on civilians and civilian deaths. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the U.S. changing role in the Middle East? Do you support ending combat operations in Iraq? Are you worried that it's happening too soon? Or do you want to see all the troops come home from Iraq sooner than later? What about the complete withdrawal from Afghanistan if you served in either or both countries? What's your reaction to what's going on? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments or questions, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ali Aboudalebi is a professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. He's an expert on Middle East politics and U.S. Middle East policy. Ali, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Let's start in Iraq. I've seen some people suggest, Ali, that saying we're ending our combat operations there, really not much has been changing. This has been kind of an ongoing process. Is this announcement a big deal?
Well, you know, the opposition would say withdrawal in such fashion, send the wrong signal to the whether through the Daesh troops or terrorists or other radical groups, and may send the wrong signal to some Iraqi leadership. But in reality, again, the United States has been there for 18 years. And the question is, what have we accomplished being there for 18 years? And we can talk about that. But again, we paid a lot of money and we lost soldiers there. And there is no way out. I mean, United States presence there cannot really solve what is Iraqi internal problems.
And looking at Iraq now, the current situation there, obviously, maybe a contrast with Afghanistan. Is Iraq, at least relative to a place like Afghanistan, relatively stable?
I'm sorry, I was answering my phone. I missed the question again. I shut that off. But the question is about Afghanistan and United States. Again, we've been there since 2001. And trillions of dollars spent and people, soldiers lost. The question is, what is it we want from Afghanistan? And how is Afghanistan's situation is connected to U.S. Security? Recall, we went there to fundamentally to destroy Al-Qaeda, which we did very quickly. And then we got involved with nation state building and staying there. And that perhaps was a wrong move to do so. And, you know, years later, then we're still asking the same question. So I was one of the advocates that the United States should not have invaded Afghanistan after 9/11. We could have resolved the issue through different methods. But even if we did, we should have withdrawn very long time ago, as opposed to getting bogged down in nation state building, which is not the job of the United States. That is, you know, you cannot fix all the problems around the world. And that kind of discussion applies even today in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, these are countries who have important neighbors, and they have to tackle with their own problems within their regional politics and context. I do understand United States have a global interest in events elsewhere, but there are close to 200 countries in the world. We cannot solve all the problems. And this kind of the U.S. withdrawal from both Afghanistan as well as Iraq, reduction in numbers of troops, but is not surprising at all. I mean, you know, we cannot be there indefinitely. So similar discussion that we could have about Iraq would apply to Afghanistan.
We're talking to Ali Aboudalebi, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, looking at the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and a transition announced this week, an end to combat operations on the way in Iraq, but 2,500 or so U.S. troops will still stay there. You could call in with your questions about those events, your thoughts on them at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Getting back to Iraq for a bit, Ali, you mentioned Daesh, also known as ISIS here. When the U.S. had initially pulled out of Iraq under the Obama administration, we saw this rise of ISIS. They've been kind of going back and forth in the Iraqi-Syrian border. The Iraqi army that had been trained by the U.S. In many ways just dissolved and collapsed initially as ISIS expanded. Is the Iraqi army and the government behind it more prepared for something like that, to prevent something like that happening again, compared to the initial rise of ISIS?
I think the answer is yes and no. That is, obviously, Iraqi army is more prepared now. But let's kind of look at the issue at closer range. Since then, again, since 2011, Syria fell into this domestic war, and varying countries, including the U.S., began supporting different troops or different groups in Syria. So what's going on in Iraq and Syria and indirectly in Afghanistan and Yemen and even in Lebanon are somewhat interconnected. So when we talk about Iraq today, Iraq had a lot of problems, including political polarization between religious groups and within religious groups and the secular forces, Iraqi nationalists, and so on and so forth. So Iraq today may be in better position to withstand Daesh or ISIL forces, but even today or yesterday, there have been at least three or four attacks against U.S. troops in Iraq, different bombing targeting U.S. convoys. There are a lot of forces against the United States, particularly the Shia groups, perhaps connected to Iran, etc. They would like to for the U.S. to withdraw. But so Iranians have an influence there among the Shiites. But there are a lot of Iraqi Sunni nationalists who they despise Iranian interference in Iraq as well. The bottom line is this: whether it's Iraq, whether it's the United States or Iran, or in the case of Afghanistan, is Pakistan or other neighboring countries, it falls to the authorities of the countries in question to resolve their own internal problems. I think what the United States can do from far away is to use its soft power through United Nations Security Council, through financial assistance, through gathering momentum with the UN Security Council and convincing the neighbors to these countries to come in and to help try resolve this, as opposed to kind of leave it alone and just say goodbye, so to speak. That's the ideal solution to me, which, again, not a lot of people are talking about. So I don't want to look at the situation of Iraq as a black and white situation, whether U.S. should stay or should U.S. United States should totally withdraw. There are things that we can do behind the scene through our soft power, but I am against the United States' long-term presence, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan, because as history has proven, you cannot really resolve anything. In the end, it's up to the people and the governments in those countries to do so.
The tricky thing, well, among the many tricky things, is that there's concern about so-called failed states. If Iraq can't maintain its own security, a group like ISIS can form. If Afghanistan can't, a group like the Taliban can take power again. And then those groups represent, the concern is, threats to neighboring countries, maybe even to the United States. How do you balance that against the worry about, as you just mentioned, being trapped, having troops there forever?
Well, at a deeper level, when you think about Taliban or when you think about Daesh, you are not necessarily talking about organization or entities. You're also talking about kind of ideology or thinking. That is, people who support Daesh or believe in Taliban, they come from a very particular narrow perspective of life and government and politics and everything else. And that is the battle within Islam, the so-called the battle between the moderates and more traditional Orthodox, which is a long discussion. I've addressed some of those in some of my writings. So what I'm saying in the long term, and even in the short and medium term, the resolution of questions of governance and the role of Islam in politics and promotion of moderation is the solution as opposed to anything else. So whether let's presume Taliban are in power tomorrow or the Daesh take over Iraq tomorrow, what are they going to do with it? The question, the United States, feeling insecure. These entities are not necessarily going to mobilize to attack the United States. They would promote through certain vision of Islam, which is very radical. So to counter them, we have to support the moderate groups in Iraq or in Afghanistan, etc. You have to support the civil society and again, moderate entities, whether in these countries or Egypt or Jordan or Lebanon, etc. And once that is settled, once the place of Islam in politics is settled, that would go a long way in bringing about more pragmatic governments in control who can be friendly to the United States. But at the very worst, they would not be hostile to the United States, but they can also be friendly. And the key, the other side of the equation to all this in terms of role of Islam in politics is the question of absence of democracy in the region. So anywhere from Afghanistan all the way to North Africa, we see authoritarian regimes in power and a shining star of Arab political movement toward democracy, that is Tunisia, we've seen lately in the last few days, having a lot of problems. So absence of democracy and the question of governance and the place of Islam within state-society relations, these are the matters that we have to address. And one pragmatic way we can do that is to promote moderate forces in the region without directly getting involved.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jack is with us in Caledonia. Jack, hi.
Yeah, hi, thanks. Very interesting topic. Now, I have a few questions. One is, with the withdrawal of the U.S. troops, how long does the guests think that it'll take for the Taliban to take over, the major cities, to stop the schools that are going on, put the Islamic, the radical Islamic way or laws into effect, threaten families with with death or whatever it is,
And Jack, I'm going to jump in. I know you had a few questions. We've got a break coming up, so that's a big one right there. Ali, how long, he wonders, before the Taliban take over major cities and impose their own, as you mentioned, a radical form of Islamic society on them?
I think the prospect is that they would do so very rapidly. A lot of it has to do with Pakistan and what role Pakistan wants to play. Pakistan has facilitated the takeover of Taliban and empowering him since the very beginning back in 1986. But what is new now is the interest by Russia and China about what's going on there, as well as India. So Pakistan can be somewhat counterbalanced by Russia, China, and India, as well as Iran, to try to promote some kind of reconciliation between Taliban and other forces and maybe mellowing out the Taliban ideological framework. What I'm saying is this is rather wishful at this point. Absence of that happening, I see Taliban quickly taking over Afghanistan, God knows within how many months, simply because they have the military support and ideological support coming from Pakistan.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're looking at President Biden's announcement this week that the U.S. combat mission in Iraq will end this year. Ali Aboudalebi is our guest. He's a political science professor at UW-Eau Claire. We're talking about Iraq and Afghanistan, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this news about U.S. involvement in Iraq? Is it time to wind down our military involvement in the Middle East in general, or are you worried about what happens after that happens. Call in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the U.S. military's involvement in the Middle East. President Biden announced this week that combat operations in Iraq will end this year. The 2,500 U.S. troops will take on advisory and training roles. That move comes as he orders all troops to withdraw from Afghanistan this summer. Ali Aboudalebi stays with us, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, where he's an expert on U.S. Middle East policy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what you're seeing from the Biden administration in places like Iraq and Afghanistan? What you want to see next? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Stan is with us in Monona. Stan, hi.
Hi. Well, you know, when we look at the war in Iraq, of course, that was based on, you know, some lies about weapons of mass destruction. And when we look at Afghanistan, well, it's all based on 9/11. And there's a gigantic amount of information to show that either we ignored it and we allowed it to happen, or that, you know, we were lied to. I mean, we had the documents come out 2 years ago saying Saudi Arabia had a hand in it. The fact that there was, you know, nanothermite found.
All right. I'm going to stop you right there. Sounds like we're getting into 9/11 conspiracy theory territory, Stan. But looking back at the early things that led to U.S. involvement in Afghanistan versus Iraq, Ali, do you want to tackle that? The initial motivations, what do you think about them?
U.S. going into Iraq, you mean?
Yes.
The caller initial point is valid. Mm-hmm. That is, we know that we went there through false pretenses.
In Iraq, yes.
In Iraq, because we know as early as 2002, when the news leaked from England, actually, that the United States was kind of gearing for invasion of Iraq, and Tony Blair and the rest of the gang, and they were gearing for Iraq anyway. But nevertheless, here we are after 18 years, and we know all the pitfalls. I personally am against direct U.S. military engagement in resolving many of the issues that U.S. may have. We have a rather bleak history when you go back to post-World War II and all these military interventions. I do understand why it happened and a variety of discussion about military industrial corporate interests and manufacture of arms and so on and so forth and the causes of war. I do understand all that. But in the end, if we argue that United States government should represent the national interest of the country, that means the interest of its people. I think there are other ways to conduct foreign policy which is more fruitful and as beneficial. For instance, even today, when we are kind of constantly trying to punish Iran or punish Syria or Venezuela or other countries through sanctions, we are not necessarily doing any service to ourselves. I am of the opinion that we can catch more bees with honey. Engagement, actually, done correctly. I'm not just talking about embracing all countries, but engagement, you could actually help a lot. For instance, with the case of Iran, this withdrawal from the JCPOA or nuclear agreement was a mistake, because during the almost 2 years of agreement, Iranian economy began to grow. Iranian moderate were empowering themselves, and pretty soon Iran would have been on its way, because the Iranian civil society is ready to embrace more secular and more pragmatic governments, and popular pressure on the government is increasing. Engagement in that sense can encourage the forces of moderation in many countries. But what we do is totally the reverse of it. And that is not helpful. So in that light, I think, yeah, we went to Iraq on the wrong pretenses, and we haven't gained much. And even today, I am of the opinion that we should actually get engaged and encourage Afghanistan and Iraqi neighbors to get involved when it comes to Persian Gulf security, or whether it comes to the concerns of India and Pakistan in Afghanistan. And recall, Afghanistan also has a small, narrow border with China. And Afghanistan is also a landlocked state with a lot of minerals. So there are a lot of complicated issues. And if you want to get kind of withdraw or get isolated from the process, we are not going to gain anything. Because, as we know, Afghanistan's neighbors are going to be there forever. And so are the Iranians and the Iraqi neighbors, et cetera. So let me just stop there.
In our last minute or so, Ali, what are you watching for next briefly in these two countries?
In terms of Iraq, as I said, there are Iraqi religious group entities, pro-Iranians and some against Iranians, some Iraqi nationalists. And then we have the instability coming from Syria and so on and so forth. Iraq has a lot of natural resources, including oil and natural gas. And Iraq can be a very prosperous country. And given its past history, Iraq can become a more secular environment politically. But that will not be resolved unless, I emphasize on that, unless we talk to the Iranians. Because, the 60% of the Iraqis will be in Shiite. They have this religious historical context with Iran. And Iranian influence is there. It's as though, when you talk about Ukraine, and you cannot ignore Russia when you talk about Ukraine and the Crimea. Similarly, when you talk about the region, you cannot simply ignore Iran in the region where there are wars and conflict, including Iraq and Yemen and Syria and so on and so forth. So a lot of potential, but things are not going to change very quickly unless we can get engaged through moderation, through use of soft power, not military power, inducement, engagement, even UN Security Council, use international institutions. Why do we resist Iranian joining the WTO, World Trade Organization? We're blocking the application for years. I think it's the wrong move. Let them come to WTO. That would force them to open their economy and eventually open to the US companies. So again, you can catch a lot more bees with honey.
Ali, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Ali Aboudalebi is professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. We talked about President Biden's announcement that U.S. combat operations in Iraq will end this year. We also checked in on Afghanistan as U.S. troops withdraw from the country completely this summer. Coming up, researchers have learned that dinosaurs traveled a lot further than previously thought, including maybe an epic voyage that started here in Wisconsin. We'll take a look at what we're discovering. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, is Wisconsin ready for renewable energy? Kate Archer-Kent and her guests take a look at the energy infrastructure here in the state and how it fits into plans to boost wind and solar production. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, scientists have found rocks from Wisconsin many miles to the west in Wyoming. Their guess as to how the rocks traveled about 1,000 miles? Dinosaurs. Scientists hypothesize that sauropods, those gigantic dinosaurs with the super long necks, swallowed the rocks to help them digest food, then made their way to Wyoming. The theory sheds some light on questions that paleontologists are starting to pay more attention to, whether dinosaurs had regular migration patterns, where they traveled to, and why. Joseph Fredrickson is director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW-Oshkosh. I talked to him earlier this year to learn more about this research, Wisconsin's prehistoric past, and how likely it might have been that dinosaurs roamed in our present-day backyards. Here's that conversation. Well, I want to start with this research that prompted this. Now, this is not a sure thing. There's some argument about whether this is really the real deal here. But tell us about this idea that we had dinosaurs eat rocks, eat Wisconsin rocks, and take them to Wyoming.
Yeah, so it's actually a really neat study that was done in the Morrison Formation of Wyoming, which is dated to about 150 million years ago. And these are rocks contain fossils of some of the most charismatic dinosaurs around, including Allosaurus, the meat-eating dinosaur, Stegosaurus, and the long-necked dinosaurs, the sauropods that you talked about. Now, the interesting thing about the Morrison Formation is that it's mostly made of mudstones, and occasionally you're going to come across these really hard, rounded cobbles made of quartzite and other hard rocks that really look out of place. And sometimes it's really difficult to see where those could possibly come from in the local area. Now, way before this study, people have hypothesized that those are actually what are called gastroliths. And gastroliths are stomach stones or stones that animals will eat to help them digest. Dinosaurs, unlike mammals, couldn't actually chew their food and digest it in the same way as, for example, cows could. So we think these sauropods and other dinosaurs would actually swallow these rocks to help grind down that plant material, and that those weird-looking stones in the rocks of the Morrison Formation are actually gastroliths.
Yeah, and this is not uncommon. I understand some birds will do this. They get some rocks down in their gizzards, and birds are just dinosaurs, really, or heavily evolved dinosaurs. So this idea isn't so weird that rocks could be traveling around by dinosaur.
No, it's not weird at all. As you mentioned, birds as well as crocodilians have been found with rocks in their stomachs, which are the closest living relatives to these dinosaurs. And we even have some dinosaurs, fossils that have been found with rocks in the right position to be these gastroliths. So it's really quite possible that those weird rocks were at one time inside a dinosaur.
Okay, but why are we thinking these weird rocks that may have been in a dinosaur ended up Wyoming? Why are we connecting them to Wisconsin?
See, that's really where this paper gets interesting. And it's because those rocks are a distinct texture and they're a distinct color. They're red quartzite. And quartzite is a metamorphic rock that used to be sand or sandstone, and it's become very, very hard. In fact, quartzite is some of the hardest rock in the entire world. Now, the red quartzite, is unique because a lot of the quartzites around that area out west aren't that deep red color. Here in Wisconsin, however, we actually have red quartzites that everyone in the state could go visit at Devil's Lake State Park, what we call the Baraboo quartzite. And these quartzites are about 1.65 billion years old. And they get their red color because they actually have hematite or iron in them, which gives them that sort of distinctive color. So researchers for this paper actually looked at zircons inside those quartzite pebbles, the red quartzites in particular, in order to reconstruct an age of those rocks. And they noticed that the age of the isotopes that they studied match up very well with the age of the Baraboo quartzite from right here in Wisconsin, and don't actually match that well with quartzites closer to Wyoming. So they're hypothesizing that those rocks were originally from Wisconsin.
Okay, now did we previously have the notion that some of these big guy dinosaurs would go on a 1,000-mile walkabout?
So we didn't know that they would walk quite that far. That's actually a very long journey, even for a big sauropod dinosaur. There have been studies that have looked at the oxygen isotopes of teeth of sauropod dinosaurs and have come to the conclusion that they may have migrated maybe as much as 300 kilometers or so upland versus lowland. And this may be related to breeding habitat for nesting or in search of food. So this would be actually quite a bit longer ways for that, but it's quite a bit possible. We really don't know a lot about the biology and the behavior of these gigantic creatures. So it's not re out of the realm of reality that they could be doing this.
We're talking to Joseph Frederickson from the Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh, looking at Wisconsin's prehistoric past and this new research showing that maybe these big sauropods went from Wisconsin to Wyoming. Evidence maybe in these rocks, these quartzite rocks along the way. Let's bring on a caller. Pete is with us in Eau Claire. Pete, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Pete?
I found a piece of petrified wood yesterday.
Cool. Pretty old. Are you a fossil hunter yourself, Pete?
I'm more of an agate guy, but I'm always kind of on the lookout for anything. So it's my first piece that I found in Wisconsin. I found some nice big pieces out in Wyoming around 2012 when I worked out there. But kind of made my day. It's got some good colors in it. It's got some red, which I believe is from the iron. So it was pretty interesting.
Pete, thanks a lot for the call. Is this a common find, Joseph, here in Wisconsin, the petrified wood?
Actually, it's not. Petrified wood is very common out west in places like the Morrison Formation of Jurassic Age or Cretaceous in age. So the time of the dinosaurs, you get a lot of petrified wood in those formations. But surprisingly, in Wisconsin, we actually don't have any rocks from that time period. We're missing the entire Mesozoic era, the time of the dinosaurs, in our fossil record. And that's largely because when the glaciers came through in the last ice age, about 20,000 years ago, they scraped all of the rocks clean off of Wisconsin and only left rocks that are older than about 385 million years ago. And during that time, which we call the Devonian period, there were plants on land, but most of Wisconsin was actually deep underwater, or at least underwater in a warm, shallow seaway. So you'd only get the plants that would actually died and floated out into the water and were later buried would you actually find those.
Thanks a lot for that call. And I wanted to ask about our absence of dinosaur fossils here in Wisconsin. Now, as I understand it, for at least some of the dinosaur era, some of Wisconsin would have been land. It wouldn't have just been water. Presumably dinosaurs could have lived here, but if they did, we got nothing to show for it. Is that right?
Exactly. So we do have evidence of Wisconsin being underwater from about 500 million years ago to about 385 million years ago. And then we lose the record. But if we look at states that are neighboring Wisconsin or ones out west, we can see that by the time of the dinosaurs, Wisconsin would have largely been on land, and we would have been situated pretty much between the Appalachian Mountains and the rising Rocky Mountains to the west. And in between that, we would have had some lowland, but it mostly would have been largely flat. So there wouldn't have been a place for there to be burial of fossils. And most of those rocks of the right age from the Jurassic or the Cretaceous largely eroded away before we could have a chance to study them. So we don't have a good record of dinosaurs here in Wisconsin. That's not to say that there aren't any rocks. There have been Cretaceous-aged rocks that have been mixed in with cobbles from the Ice Age that have been found out west in Wisconsin. But so far, really, it's been limited to plant fossils that have been found in those, and so far, no dinosaurs yet.
We're listening back to our conversation with Joseph Fredrickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW-Oshkosh. We talked back in April about research into the migratory habits of dinosaurs and why we don't know a lot about dinosaur history here in Wisconsin. One recent theory, rocks from Wisconsin that were found in Wyoming made the 1,000-mile trip in the bellies of sauropods that ate them to help digest food. Coming up, we'll hear from some fossil hunters in Wisconsin who have questions about what they've found in the field and where they can take their finds to get properly identified. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we continue listening back to my conversation with Joseph Fredrickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW-Oshkosh. I talked to him back in April about what life looked like in Wisconsin tens of millions of years ago. We're finding out what we know about the dinosaurs that lived here, why some may have migrated west to present-day Wyoming, and what questions paleontologists still have about the area's past. To kick off the second half of the conversation, we hear from Greg in Waukesha, who called in to ask about the geological barriers potentially facing a dinosaur as it migrated from Wisconsin to Wyoming.
You know, I'm really trying to bend my mind around a dinosaur that size walking 1,000 miles. The other thing that is in my mind, isn't there a mountain range that they'd have to cross? And I don't think they like high elevations where it gets cold.
Interesting questions, Greg. Now, there's a mountain range now. Was there necessarily one there then, Joseph?
Yeah, it's a great question. Actually, the Rocky Mountains and a lot of the mountains that you have around there were actually formed after the Morrison Formation was deposited in the Cretaceous period. So they could be as much as 60 million years younger than the dinosaurs. So at the time, we would actually have seen fairly flat land between Wyoming and Wisconsin, with most of the highlands being to the west of Wyoming and to the east of Wisconsin. The paper actually does bring in the possibility that there was a river that actually ran between the Appalachians all the way to Wyoming, basically cutting through Wisconsin, and may have actually picked up some of these stones along the way, meaning that these dinosaurs may not have actually had to walk all the way to Wisconsin to get them. They might have been able to pick them up somewhere downstream before that river flowed into Wyoming.
Thanks for that call. I'm going to stick with Wisconsin, though. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Racine. Chris, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a beachcomber, and I have found lots of crinoids and shells that are from that period. However, I found some things that are kind of odd, like something that looks like it would be a hoof, but it's petrified. And a piece of a jawbone and what looks like a petrified knuckle bone, but I can't tell. It's a different size than I would expect to see on anything. So where could I find out? Could I send a picture someplace? Is there someplace that I can find out what these things might be?
Interesting, Chris. Is there a place where, you know, people out there finding things like this, Joseph, could go to identify them?
Bring them to the museum, the Weiser Science Museum. I'm happy to identify them. I'm a paleontologist by trade, and part of what we do for the public is actually identify these really cool finds, because as paleontologists, we can't be everywhere. It's actually much more common for people who have an interest in rock hunting to pick these things up and bring them to us, and who knows, they might be very, very important. As you said, the crinoids are very, very ancient that you'll find on the beaches around Lake Michigan. Some of those date back to around 420 million years ago, well before the dinosaurs. But it sounds like the bones that you have, including the hoof or the knuckle bone, might actually be of the Ice Age, about 20,000 years old or somewhere around there, and could be from some of the animals, the mammals that were walking around here as the glaciers were retreating, not as long ago as some of those other fossils.
Great question, Chris. And I know from visits to geology museums, Joseph, that, well, we don't necessarily have a lot in the way of dinosaur remains here in Wisconsin. Those more recent guys you were talking about, the Ice Age people, we had, mammoths and things like that. Can you talk about where we do have more abundant fossil records in the state?
So our fossil record is the really old stuff and the really young stuff. So the animal fossils begin about 500 million years ago in what we call the Cambrian period. And these will include things like trilobites, but also trackways of some of the first animals to crawl out of the ocean and onto land. Around 385 million years ago in the Devonian period, which is also known as the Age of Fish, we had some really cool animals, including large armored fish swimming around the oceans of Milwaukee. And then we have that gap where we really have a lack of knowledge of what was here. But we picked that back up at the Ice Age about 20,000 years ago. And as you said, we have mammoths. We had mastodons that would have been walking around in our own backyard. But we also had some more interesting creatures, I think, like a giant bear-sized beaver called Castoroides. That was here, as well as the possibility of dire wolves, large saber-toothed cats, and even ground sloths would have been in the area.
We're talking to Joseph Fredrickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW-Oshkosh, looking at Wisconsin's prehistoric history. Our starting point today, this research saying maybe some of these dinosaurs wandered from Wisconsin to Wyoming. You mentioned there the oceans of Milwaukee. And that, you know, that's kind of mind-blowing to think about. Can you talk about how much this spot on Earth we call Wisconsin has changed over the eons?
It has changed tremendously. As I mentioned, the rocks in question of this study from the Baraboo quartzite are 1.65 billion years old. Now, the sand to make that quartzite actually comes from mountains that were actually in northern Wisconsin. And we actually can imagine having a mountain range actually cutting through the state. More recently, when we actually would have some of these animal fossils, like during the Cambrian or Devonian periods, Wisconsin was actually positioned south of the equator, and the entire continent was turned clockwise so that what would be where Lake Michigan is now would actually be to our south. So Wisconsin was actually much warmer back then, and it was actually under a shallow seaway, so warm that we would actually have coral reefs growing in the state.
And there is, I ran across this, and I keep meaning to actually have a guest on to talk about this in specific. There's a geologic era named after Wisconsin, the Wisconsinian or Wisconsinian era or period or something like that. That's all I know. Is that a thing?
Yes, it actually is. So it's a little bit, it's not quite as extensive as an era. It's actually a stage within the last ice age. Essentially, the last ice age, when that last lobe of the glacier came down from Canada, it essentially stopped in its tracks right in the middle of Wisconsin. And that's why we have what's called the Driftless Area in the west that looks on a map way different than the rest of Wisconsin does to the east. And it lacks all the features that are created by glaciers, like the lakes that you see dotting all over eastern and northern Wisconsin. And geologists name those time periods in the glaciation cycles based on where you can see the evidence of them best. So previous to the Wisconsin, you have some that were in Illinois and Nebraska and Kansas, which are named for those states respectively. But the last one, and probably the most impressive one, is from Wisconsin.
And Joseph, in our last couple of minutes, I want to get back to dinosaurs in Wisconsin. We can be pretty sure they were here, even though we don't have much in the way of direct evidence. With a study like this showing Wisconsin rocks maybe traveling by dinosaur stomach or gizzard or something, are you hopeful that we can get indirect evidence that could help establish what kind of creatures we had here?
Absolutely. There's really no reason to believe that the dinosaurs that we have in Wyoming wouldn't be the exact same ones that we would find in Wisconsin. There wasn't any clear barrier that was keeping them out. So this study, I think it's really nice because it's a reminder to us of how interconnected just the continent would have been during the Jurassic. And it also helps us here in Wisconsin, feel like we're a part of that fossil record, because there's no Jurassic sediments here in Wisconsin, but at least there's a little part of Wisconsin in the Jurassic sediments.
What can we see online right now at the Weiss Museum, whether we're in town or far away, just in our last few moments?
So we are open on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and we have a brand new exhibit called Animals Through Time that talks about the evolution of animals from the Precambrian all the way through the modern record. And that was part of a big donation that was given to us by Bruce Danz, a local collector and physician in the Appleton area. Online, we do have a YouTube page where we're actually updating virtual field trips that go to different parts of the state and show you some of the geologic history. Right now, we have one from Sheridan Park in Cudahy that looks at the glacial record of hills that you'll see around there, as well as one in Mosinee County looking at Blackberry Hill, which is from the Cambrian period and has evidence of some of those first animals to crawl out of the ocean and leave trackways in the rocks that you can still see today.
Ooh, I'll have to check that out. Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Joseph Fredrickson, director of the Weiss Earth Science Museum at UW Oshkosh. I talked to him in April about the discovery of rocks unique to Wisconsin winding up in Wyoming and the theory that dinosaurs may have transported them in their stomachs as they migrated west millions of years ago. If you have questions about dinosaurs or the state's prehistoric past, maybe something you'd like to hear talked about on a future show, let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, more hospitals and clinics around the U.S. are mandating vaccines for their employees. We'll find out what's going on, and you can share your thoughts on the idea. Love to hear from you if you work in a hospital yourself. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with recipes that help you learn to cook while you cook. We'll meet the author of the book, Cook This Book. That more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. We just heard about dinosaurs there. When we're talking about dinosaur fossils, we're talking about things from 65 million years ago or more. That's pretty old, I guess. But you know what's older? How about a fossil that's 890 million years old? It exists, and it's the oldest animal fossil on record. In a paper published this week in Nature, a fossil found in Canada was dated 890 million years ago. It looks like it's an impression of an early sponge, and sponges are, weirdly, animals. This sponge is a sign that animal life existed on Earth before it seemed like it should have been possible, given the hostile environment on the planet back in the old days. Now, it can be hard just looking at a sponge to tell that it's alive, much less an animal form of life. And this ancient sponge fossil is no exception. The researcher found it more than 20 years ago, but she waited for a couple decades of analysis before making the case that it was, in fact, a super ancient sponge. I mean, sponges, they don't do much, right? They just sit there chilling in the ocean, absorbing nutrients and just living. They've done it for 890 million years. That doesn't sound so bad, actually. We'll learn from the sponge. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.